As many of you know, most of you know, on Friday, our entire country is going to celebrate this odd, almost 200-year-old superstition that was started by the Pennsylvania Dutch. And reporters from all over the country and more than 40,000 people are going to descend on this little town in Pennsylvania called Punxsutawney to watch a groundhog named Phil give us his weather prediction. I think it's bizarre that we celebrate that. And I love the crazy logic of that. Most of you know this. So if on Friday there happens to be a clear sky in this little bitty town in Pennsylvania and Phil sees his shadow, the entire country is going to have 6 more weeks of winter. But if it happens to be cloudy on Friday, we can all celebrate that spring is going to arrive early this year. So according to modern-day statistics, all the different groundhogs over the years named Phil have only been correct 39% of the time. Not a very good average. But I think it's such a fun day for all of us, mainly because it reminds us, thankfully, that spring is indeed on its way, right? It's just a great reminder. And so tonight, in honor of this strange national holiday that we have, I want to talk a little bit about a movie with the same name. Mm-hmm. And just for a show of hands, who has not seen Groundhog Day? Okay, John, Connie, that's it? Okay, that's your assignment. Really? Wow, okay, but everybody else has? Mm-hmm. Yay, okay, good. Sorry, you guys. Well, I hope I don't ruin it for you. So, I know a few of you told me also that they watched the you watched the movie last week as homework. Who did that? Yeah, yeah. So, just to give you some background, about 25 years or so ago now, when I was studying Buddhism at Naropa University, one of our teachers surprised us one day by passing out popcorn, and we didn't know what she was doing. And she ended up showing this film, which, by the way, had just come out recently. It was 1993. I feel very old right now, but that's what it was. And we spent the whole week actually studying, every day studying this film and the lessons that we gained from it. And the reason our teacher was showing us this movie is because almost as soon as it was released, it became kind of an underground Buddhist classic, okay? And the movie's director, Harold Ramis, grew up in a Jewish household, but he was highly influenced by Buddhist philosophy, first through his college roommate, who ended up becoming a Buddhist monk, a Zen monk, and then by his mother-in-law, who spent 3 decades in a Buddhist monastery. So highly influenced. And he apparently used to wear a Buddhist prayer bracelet around his wrist, and in interviews he called himself an existentialist with a dash of Buddhism. And even today, Buddhist teachers all over the country still show this film to their students for many reasons. And I actually really wish I had time to show it to you all tonight so we could review it. And for those of you, again, who haven't seen it, I hope I'm not going to totally ruin it for you, but maybe you can look at it with new eyes if you see it. So to summarize the plot, the movie is about this very self-centered, egotistical TV weatherman named Phil Connors, who you may notice has the same first name as the gopher, which I like. And when the movie starts, our character is generally being a pain in the butt to everyone around him, mainly because that seems to be his nature, but also because he has a very big ego and it's been wounded because he's been assigned to travel to that little town to report on Groundhog Day, which he thinks is just really beneath him, that he has to go do this assignment. And as fate would have it, if you remember, he gets stuck in what he sees as this little hick town because of a blizzard. Of course, he didn't predict. He failed at that. And he ends up in a time loop that makes him relive the same day over and over and over. And so, as you might imagine, you know, our character kind of freaks out a little bit about this, and he feels like he's going crazy, like he's living in his own little world. And no one else beside him seems to be noticing that they're living the same day over and over. It's just him that's starting to notice this. And for some of you, you might remember feeling this way when you first started meditating. Anyone? I mean, I know I did. I have to confess, I remember feeling like I'd been living in a kind of dream world, and I was suddenly very aware of this and how unreal everything started to feel when I started practicing. And this is actually not a problem for those of you who experience it. It's just the start of waking up. We're waking up. And in the movie, what happens first is Phil starts to acknowledge that he's truly stuck in this little town, or his little world, if you will. We're stuck here. And he doesn't like it. And so we might as well make the best of it and make the best of what he considers a bad situation. So he says in the movie, I'm not going to live by their rules anymore. Not going to live by their rules. So he just lets go of all restraint and becomes totally self-indulgent. So he starts chain-smoking, and he orders a whole menu of donuts and cakes and sausages for breakfast, like the entire menu. And then he happily punches a man in the street who's been annoying him. He's just really leaning into his greed and his anger, just going for it. And the movie's director said he intentionally added this Buddhist subplot about karma here. He says, yes, no consequences, no cause and effect, so empowered. He doesn't realize yet it's a trap that his ego has set for him. The power to do whatever you want is a common, delightful fantasy. Really like that. And so true to his teaching of karma, Phil soon realizes that this living a life of all-out hedonism and greed and violence is really ultimately unsatisfying. And so he starts to believe then what he really needs for a sense of meaning and purpose in his life is to gain the love of his pretty director, who's played by Andy McDowell. And he goes about plotting to figure out how he's going to do this. And he realizes what he needs to do first is really to get to know her. And he recognizes that he needs to become more interested in what she wants than what he wants. FYI, guys. Right. So he also starts paying very close attention to everything that's happening around him in order to do this. And as he does, we kind of watch him become more and more mindful, simply by slowing down, because he has all the time in the world. He slows down, and he really starts examining, taking a closer look at everything, really getting curious about it. And, of course, along with getting slapped in the face a lot by Andy McDowell, maybe hundreds of times, his plan does eventually start to work. But because he's striving for this, working towards a kind of selfish goal of convincing her about how amazing he is and obtaining his love, his efforts end up coming off as inauthentic, and he can't continue to recreate the same romantic day or when her love doesn't work. And here you might recognize a very key Buddhist teaching, which is that whenever we try to force happiness and then maybe try to grasp and hold on to it, make it last, make it permanent and somehow reliable, we realize how much stress that causes us. Since everything, including ourselves, is ultimately impermanent and fleeting. And so far, our character has tried and failed to discover happiness in many ways. Hedonism and violence doesn't seem to work. Trying to control everything doesn't work. Trying to obtain the object of his desire doesn't work either, right? And so as you might expect, he ends up falling into a sense of meaninglessness or nihilism, where he just wants to end it all. He just wants to make it go away. And at this point in the movie, he asks a group of his friends, what would you do if you were stuck in one place and every day was exactly the same and nothing really mattered? To which his drinking buddy responds, that about sums it up for me. So at this point in the movie, we watch him do all kinds of crazy things to try to kill himself over and over. One day, I think he stands in front of a bus. Another day, he drops a toaster into the bathtub. And then he throws himself off the cliff along with the gopher. Sadly, when even this doesn't work, and he continues to wake up every day over and over, he says, "I've killed myself so many times, I don't even exist anymore." And I really like the way the director talked about this in an interview. He said, "In Groundhog Day, Phil destroys all meaning for himself. Buddhism says our self doesn't even exist. The self is a convenient illusion that gives us ego. In conventional terms, of course, it exists. There's a name and a picture on your driver's license. You have to get dressed in the morning, and your paycheck is addressed to someone. So you have a self. But it's really an illusion. I did a group exercise, and we were asked to face another person and describe ourselves in 2 minutes. I started describing myself, and from the very first statement started thinking, that's not really true. That's what I like to think about myself, but I'm not as good as I'm saying. It's all a projection." And at this place in the movie, the director suggested, "It usually takes hitting the bottom of a barrel for man to seek spiritual redemption. Now," he says, "Phil is ready for change." And I think the Buddha would agree with this in the sense that when you hit the bottom of the barrel, it implies that it's empty, doesn't it? It implies that it's empty. And in Buddhist understanding, this means that it's empty of self, a self who believes that it's in charge, the center of the known universe. It's empty of self. And you heard that term in Buddhist terminology, that's what it's talking about. And when we reach this state, it really is a place of deeply letting go, a full surrender. And in the movie, our character does surrender in a way, in that he lets go of trying to chase the girl, if you will, trying to get her to love him. And he decides to use his time to develop mastery. And over the years, we don't know how many, maybe decades, likely, he learns to master things like the piano and French poetry and even ice sculpture. And in the same way with our practice, this is the place where we start becoming really interested in mastering the art of meditation practice. And what this means is mastering the art of knowing ourselves, looking really deeply within in order to, as the Buddhist nun Pema Chodron says, to get to know humanness altogether. To get to know humanness altogether. So in the film, as our character continues on his path of mastery, he discovers more and more about himself in the process. And as he does, inevitably, he starts to spend more time with all the people in the town. He really gets to know all the people that he used to call hicks. He gets to know them very intimately and slowly learns everything about them. And of course, once he gets to know them, he actually starts to love them. And then he very naturally wants to start to take care of them. That's the process. And the Buddha would likely say that this caring for others arose very organically from what are called the two wings of practice, which are wisdom and compassion. Those two are the wings of practice. So as our character has gained knowledge about himself through his practice, he realizes finally that he really isn't separate from the town, from everyone around him. And he naturally wants to extend his care. So a quote I love from Pema Chodron really expresses this process. Bless you. She says, "In order to have compassion for others, we have to have compassion for ourselves. In particular, to care about other people who are fearful, angry, jealous, overpowered by addictions of all kinds, arrogant, proud, miserly, selfish, mean, you name it. To have compassion and to care for these people means not to run away from the pain of finding these things in ourselves." I just think that's such a profound teaching. So eventually then our hero begins to find true meaning in living in service to others. So we watch him, you know, catch a boy falling from a tree, and you can't imagine how many days he's done the same thing, right? He helps a group of older women in their car. They might have been in an accident or almost about to get into one. Saves the mayor from choking. And there's this very poignant moment in the movie that kind of made me teary. It's a comedy, but I got teary-eyed at this part in the movie where it shows him trying to save an old man who is begging on the streets, who he had originally passed without notice, kind of with irritation. Like, oh, there's this homeless man. And then he starts trying over and over to save him. And yet, even though he tries again and again, each time the man ends up dying, every time. And so there's also this deep recognition, again, of the inevitability of death and impermanence, something that we all have in common, something that binds us all. And in the movie, Phil asks someone a really important question, and I think it's something that we all might really chew on, which is, what if there is no tomorrow? He says, there wasn't one today. What if there is no tomorrow? There wasn't one today. Right? And someday that's going to happen. So Phil also realizes here very experientially that truly he's not in control. And in Buddhist terms, our character has come to recognize the truth of what are considered the three characteristics of life. There is suffering, dukkha. Everything's impermanent, anicca. And we are not alone, anatta, no self. And with this understanding, this wisdom, there's an even deeper, more authentic opening of his heart. And very gradually, we watch him let go of all selfishness and enter a kind of selfless intent on simply living each day fully and giving joy and kindness and compassion to others in the best way he can without any sense of doing it for gain or for his ego. There's no sense of ego in it. Harold Ramis, the director, said this is something in the movie that he was really pointing to. He said, serenity is an illusion, but if anything is possible and I can do anything, then there is a limitless capacity to do good. There's a limitless capacity to do good. So in our final analysis, our character essentially becomes really a bodhisattva, which is a person who is intent on selflessly working towards his own enlightenment as a way to benefit all sentient beings. We talked about that intention last week. And again, he's living out the intention of a bodhisattva, which I spoke about, or we chanted last week, the sharing of aspiration or merit, which includes the main intention of, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. It's a main intention in that chant we did. And of course, when he reaches this state, his love interest does finally fall in love with him, but not through his manipulation of her. It's because of who he has become through his acts of kindness and selflessness. And I love the way Ram Dass describes this. He says, the most important aspect of love is not in giving or receiving, it is in the being. When I need love from others, or need to give love to others, I'm caught in an unstable situation. Being in love, rather than giving or taking love, is the only thing that provides stability. Being in love means seeing the beloved all around me. Right? And so really, Phil got to that state of seeing the beloved all around him. And as I was writing this talk, it slowly dawned on me why we spent an entire week on this movie when I was studying it there at Naropa. And it's because it's really dense with Buddhist teachings. I kind of kept going on and on. It's like, oh, there's this concept and that concept, and which one's the most important? And so I'm going to talk about just a couple of these in the time we have left. And the one that seems to be the most talked about in Buddhist studies groups is the concept of samsara. And this is a kind of complicated Buddhist idea that says, because of our inability to let go of a solid sense of self or ego, and the resulting greed, aversion, and delusion that we experience due to our strong tendency to cling to our ego selves, we continue to be born and die and be born and die again and again through many different lifetimes, and therefore we continue to suffer. It's a cycle, it's a wheel of samsara. That's the idea with Buddhist practice. And the imagery in this movie really points to this concept of samsara with the image of the alarm clock and fills in. And every morning it pumps out the same cheesy song by Sonny and Cher over and over. Babe, dun-dun, I got you, babe. All right, do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
And by the way, I also love that Phil is staying in an inn, not a permanent home, because, you know, he's simply renting the room, which is what we're all doing. You know, it's that we all have these bodies that we're living in, but they're not ours, and they're not us, right? They're not us. I'm actually, in another life, a 6-foot-tall man. In my mind. So, it's not us, and we also don't get to keep them, and yet we constantly identify with our bodies and believe that they're us and forget that they're temporary, which again points to the truth of impermanence and change in Nietzsche. And I want to stop and point out here that even if you don't believe in reincarnation or other lives, that kind of stuff in Buddhist practice, in modern psychological terms, what samsara is pointing to is something we tend to do in this lifetime, which is that we tend to revisit all our old stuff, all our old issues and stories over and over in many different versions, right? And because of our strong conditioning, we tend to keep doing the same things over and over. We do the same things. In fact, we make the same mistakes sometimes, or, you know, I find it interesting that we tend to have the same arguments over and over, right? Maybe with the one common argument for each family member. I have this argument with that person over and over, and this argument with that person over and over, and it has a similar theme and taste to it. And yet, we also tend to continue to believe that somehow, someday, we'll have different results from doing the same thing over and over. And when this doesn't happen, we suffer. So when we step onto this path of mindfulness, the idea is that just like Phil, we might initially feel like we're going a little crazy, that things have shifted a bit. So the people around us might suddenly start to seem like they're stuck in the same loop, and we've stepped out of it a little bit, you know, even if just a little bit. Anybody sense that when you start practice? It's like, wow, seeing the bigger picture. And the more we can slow down and do this, step out of the loop and start really paying attention, the more we can start to notice exactly what it is that we're believing and how we're acting out on these beliefs all the time. We start to see how in many ways we're creating our own reality, and we begin to better understand what the Dalai Lama meant when he said, happiness is not something ready-made. It comes from our own actions. Happiness is not something ready-made. It comes from our own actions. And the more we can start to see clearly what's not working in our lives, what's causing ourselves and others to suffer, we start to change not only our thinking, how we're perceiving and relating to things, but we also start to change our behavior. The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, no man ever steps in the same river twice, for it's not the same river, and he's not the same man. And we see this happening in the movie, our character is not actually repeating the same day over and over. because of one significant thing, which is him, right? He is the one thing that's changing, and he can't control anything else except for that, right? He can't control anything else besides him. And what happens? It changes everything. And so this is where the teaching of intention comes in our practice, with the idea of, if I can change one little thing, I can change everything. Okay? And it's often, you know, been said, when things start to change inside of you, that's when they start to change around you. And most of the time, though, we try to do exactly the opposite of this, don't we? Mm-hmm. We try to control this person and that person and this situation, and we try to control everything else around us, except for we don't want to look in here. And that's where the change needs to happen. And according to Buddhist teachings, this might actually take many lifetimes. A traditional example compares the practice of meditation to a bird that drags a silk scarf across the top of a mountain. And the mountain of ego wears away very slowly, and yet the only thing to do is to keep drawing that scarf over it every day. Every day. So I don't want this to depress you, that last example of how long it might take, but to use it as encouragement to not be so hard on yourself. You know, since whenever we have the intention to change, you have to remember that it's going to take time. It's the intention that's important. We're going to make mistakes. It's actually an important part of the practice, making mistakes. And yet we just tend to beat ourselves up so harshly when we have an intention for something and we fail over and over and over again, right? According to the teachings and myths, the Buddha's own enlightenment took an infinite number of lifetimes as different humans as well as animals, and he made mistake after mistake after mistake, apparently four incalculables and 100,000 eons, right? It takes a little while. And when he started his journey as a monk named Sumedha, he apparently asked himself, how can I make this vast journey? What aspects of mind and heart do I need to develop in order to become a Buddha? And as he reflected, he saw that there were 10 wholesome qualities that he would need to cultivate. And these included generosity, virtue, or moral conduct, renunciation, or letting go, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Anybody know, recognize what those are? Yeah. So those are the paramis, which is usually translated as the perfections. And the word parami in Pali is actually related to another Pali word, which is paramam, which means something of foremost importance. So these aren't something that, you know, you need to beat yourself up about perfecting. Again, it's a practice. They are of utmost importance. And so with the intention of learning from his mistakes, the Buddha began the journey of innumerable lifetimes to cultivate these perfections of heart and mind. And according to the stories, they eventually unfolded into him becoming the Buddha 2,600 years ago. And of course, with most stories of the Buddha, I hope you mostly take this as myth, these stories, but I hope you get the idea that you can apply these same things to your own life. So the director of the film said that for him, the key lesson from the movie is to become mindful of all those moments when, quote, you are about to make that same old mistake again. He says, we face those changes every day, large and small, every single day. If you change one little thing, one little behavior, then everything might change. So you might even here see another main thing of the movie, which is really, I think, the same reason that we celebrate Groundhog Day, which is the theme of hope, right? The theme of hope. As these teachings show us, we can always and forever, always let go and begin again, because in each moment, we and everything around us is really brand new, you know, especially if we make a more conscious effort to notice that it's new. That's what the teachings are asking us to do. Notice that it's new. In the Zen tradition, there's a saying, every breath, new chances. It's another sticky note, right? Every breath, new chances. And in talking about this aspect of the film, the Buddhist teacher Lewis Richard tells us that every day, even the most tragic, has within it the seeds of renewal, of spring. Depending on how Phil the groundhog sees his shadow, winter could go on or not. Depending on how Phil Connors responds to each new day, he could grow and change or not. At the end of the film, Phil wakes up happy one morning and he surprises a stranger with a hug and a quote from Samuel Coleridge. And he says, "Winter, slumbering in the open air, wears on its smiling face a dream of spring." So I think I will leave you with that and invite you just to settle for a quick meditation on this. So just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. Maybe a couple of rounds of these just to get in touch again with your body, breath. And those of you who'd like to, I'm going to invite to place one hand on the heart and one hand on the belly and just breathe into the fingers, really sensing into the heart, tapping in to your sense of wisdom and compassion, those two wings of practice. And they both emanate from the heart. They both do. Invite you as we continue just to place a contemplation in the heart, not in the head. What small thing in your life could you change that might make a difference in it? Maybe it's a habit or behavior that you like to change. What's one small thing you could do differently? Remembering this might be something really small or minor. Doesn't have to be a big change. What small thing could you change that might make a difference? It could even be a change in a relationship or whatever it is. Remembering also the importance of intention rather than perfection. You might even make an intention, if you've discovered that one small thing, just to write it down somewhere where you can see it. Really make it concrete, your intention. Or make a vow to yourself in your heart. finally, just listening to these words by Portia Nelson, who writes autobiography in 5 short chapters. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I've fallen again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see that it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit, but my eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. I hope you enjoyed this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.